You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, Launch Streeters? Tamara here, your host, innovation enabler, and lover of Sharpie colored markers. I just think it's better to take notes in color. I don't know. I think it creates different connections in my brain. I absolutely love it. Right now, I'm using orange, brown, and green. So good. Okay, let's dig in. So in this episode of Inside Launch Street, I bring on Greg Sotel, who I'll tell you a little bit about in a minute. What I actually want to start with is what we talk about and why I think that's so important for all of you out there listening, all of you innovators. So we talk about it. Actually, let me break it down this way. The overarching theme of our conversation, and you hear us actually talk about it in the beginning, is the fact that we're transforming the era that we're in one from where we were coming from, which is iterating what we know, like optimizing, editing, adjusting what we already know, what we already understand, into exploring new things we don't yet understand. I bet a lot of you are out there nodding your heads because it feels that way in your own work. But that's a fundamental shift in how we have to think about our work, our lives, how we tackle the challenges around us, how we come up with new solutions, because iterating is not enough. I think a lot of you have heard me talk about similar things about, you know, better, stronger, faster, kind of the ER trap, the ER trap is not enough. And Greg really helps me put some language around why that is so important. And I'd like to add to that, that if you haven't, now's the time to go get your Innovation Quotient Edge assessment results. Why? Because this assessment, the one that we have on our website, actually tells you how you innovate. And I firmly believe, and I have seen and experienced, particularly as we shift eras, that that ability to innovate is your greatest advantage. That's how you know how to deal with this new era that we're in. That's what's going to help you work smarter, not harder, and actually make it easier for you to shift into this new era of exploring what we don't know. Now, if you've taken the free level and just dip your toe in, that's great. But I want you to go back and get your full report because you don't have your full archetype. You only know one piece of the puzzle. There's two other pieces that you're missing. And here's the thing. It's the complete combination that's your unique innovator archetype. It's the concert between all three of them that helps you gain the advantage. So if you haven't taken it yet, go to our website. Just click on the Take Free Assessment. Take it, and then invest in yourself and get the report. Don't just dip your toe in the water. That's not enough. We got to be all in for innovation. Go get the report. And if you have done the free level, the promo level, go back and click on Shop by IQE, and we'll get you that report quick. All right, let me go back to Greg. So Greg Sotel is a popular author, speaker, and innovation advisor. He just released a book, which I thought was fantastic. It's why I asked him to be on the show, called Mapping Innovation, A Playbook for Navigating a Disruptive Age. It was actually selected as one of the best business books of 2017 by 800 CEO Read. It's a pretty incredible book. I would encourage you to go get the book at some point. So Greg regularly contributes to the Harvard Business Review and Inc., as well as other A-list publications. And he's consistently ranked one of the top 10 innovation bloggers in the world. Clearly, you can see why I wanted to have him on. And this, like I said, this whole conversation about moving from iterating to what we know to exploring what we don't understand is something we all need to pay attention to. All right, let's do this. Greg, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Tamara.
So what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I would say the one thing that a lot of people are surprised about me is that I spent 15 years in former Soviet countries in Eastern Europe. It probably won't be so surprising a year from now, because my book, my new book, which is coming out in the spring, has an entire chapter about that.
And so, what made you go over there to start? Can you just give us the Reader's Digest about why you even headed that way?
Well, somebody offered me a job in Poland in 1997, and I was working in a big corporation. And it seemed like, well, if I don't do this now, I'll never do it. So I thought I was going for 6 months. I didn't know I was going to be for 15 years. and I spent about 6 years in Poland, about 8 years on and off in Ukraine, some time in Moscow, some time in Istanbul. And probably the most exciting thing I did there was I was leading a large news organization. Well, actually, a large media company with a large news organization in the middle of the Orange Revolution.
Oh, wow. God, what a great experience. So this kind of leads me to my first question, because it clearly you have a lot of global experience to kind of go with all of this. So in your book, Mapping Innovation, you talk about the fact that we're entering a new era of innovation. So tell me about that new era.
Well, yeah, I think first we should start with the era that we're in, okay, which we commonly term the digital revolution. And it's really been driven by our ability to cram more transistors on a silicon wafer, to double the amount of transistors we can cram on a silicon wafer every 18 to 24 months. And we've gotten really, really good at doing that. And we understand the basic fundamental technologies and how they work really, really well. So probably not surprisingly, a lot of the value has shifted towards the front end, things like design, user experience, user interface, all those behavioral and design type things. And a lot of the emphasis on innovation has gone to things like rapid iteration and prototyping. However, that digital revolution is coming to an end, because Moore's law, that process of doubling transistors, is coming to an end. If it hasn't, it's debatable whether it hasn't already ended. The new chips, the 7-nanometer chips, might or might not be economically viable. And just in terms of technical feasibility, we might be able to get to 3 or 4 nanometers. I don't think we'll ever get to 1. But just look, the atoms
are
only
so. So we've hit capacity.
Yeah. So what do we do after that? Well, a lot of things that people don't really understand how to do. Things like new computing architectures. We know what they are. We know we have quantum computers. We know they exist. We know they can work. We have neuromorphic chips, but they work on a completely different logic. They have they compute in completely different ways. So we need new computer languages. We also don't understand the outputs that well. So we're going to have to figure that out. At the same time, there's new technologies that are emerging that I put in the category of bits driving atoms. Genomics is moving very, very quickly, much, much faster than Moore's law ever did. There's a real revolution going on in materials science, which is going to affect everything from energy to manufacturing to lots of other things. So the big shift is going to be moving from iterating these technologies that we understand really well to exploring and trying to understand these new technologies that we don't understand very well at all. So the new era will look much more like innovation in the 1950s or 60s than it did in the 90s or the aughts.
What do you mean by that? I want to make sure I'm not being assumptive on, like, what? Oh my goodness. Was that the presidential alert?
That was the presidential alert.
There so it is.
Obviously, the entire country is very excited about this
new era. We all heard it. There it was. This new era right there. Oh, that was what great timing.
That was the signal that it is real and it is happening.
If you're, you know, we'll release this a couple months from now, but that was the first ever presidential alert to all cell phones, right?
That's so crazy.
Oh, my gosh. That timing was crazy. Okay. And we're not going to edit out that because that was just too good to be true. That was perfect. My question for you is, so for those of us who weren't, I mean, I'm in my 40s, so I remember the 70s and 80s quite well. But tell me what the 50s and 60s innovation looked like. What can we expect that to look like now? How does that work?
So really, in the late 40s, 1950s, everything changed. That was the first era of big science. Mm. There was no big science before the 1940s. And during the 1940s, it was, you know, focused on building weapons, like radar,
right.
Nuclear technologies, antibiotics. So the 1950s, we all of a sudden had all of these new things, like digital computing and like antibiotics and nuclear energy, nuclear medicine. So just a bunch of really new revolutions that nobody quite understood. And nobody really understood them until the 1960s. That's when everything sped into high gear. That's when we were coming up with all sorts of new antibiotics every single year. That's when IBM launched its 360 class of mainframes, which dominated the next two decades. That's when a lot of things happened, and we started to see practical uses of technology, and it created an economic boom like we hadn't seen since the 1920s, and when electricity and the automobile really started to hit their gear.
So here's my question about all that, because I hear you, and we have a lot of innovators who listen to the show, and they work in everything from, you know, corporations to their entrepreneurs. The question I have is that's kind of noodling around in my brain as you're talking is, oh my God, what do I need to have my eye on to make sure I'm staying relevant? Because I think, you know, what I hear a lot from people when I speak across the globe is like, I'm trying to stay relevant. My job is changing. Technology is changing my job. Things are getting automated and I'm trying to stay relevant. And now you're telling me, which I totally get, but there's this big shift coming. What do I as the individual need to have my eye on to make sure that I'm at least keeping up?
I don't think there is, you know, when there was one technology, digital technology, it was pretty easy to come up, to keep up.
You just had to keep up with the latest and greatest.
Well, you also knew, right? You also knew that the capacity would double in 18 months.
Right.
So if you were doing things with audio, right, if you would say, okay, well, we're going to have video. Right. If, you know, streaming video is coming.
And it'll get better and it'll get faster.
Right. You could see it. You could see the early technologies, but they didn't work very well. And everybody said, well, in 2 years, they will work very well. And we need to shift our business models.
Right.
You can't do that anymore. You have to go look for the technologies that are important to your business. For instance, if you have a manufacturing business, right? Mm-hmm. There are a number of important technologies, from advanced fabrics to 3D printing to composite materials and on and on and on. You will not be at the forefront of that revolution. However, there are, I think, 14 manufacturing hubs that the U.S. government has set up. And an associate membership costs anywhere from $0 to $15,000. You need to be there if those things are important to your business. There's something called the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research. If advanced batteries will affect your business, you really need to be there. With quantum computing, you already see IBM and Rigetti starting up networks of companies that are learning how to use the data that comes out of quantum computers. So you will not be able to stay relevant by sitting around a conference table and thinking up big ideas. You will stay relevant by getting out and connecting with the people who are doing it. This next era of innovation will be far, far more interdisciplinary and collaborative than the last one was. And it won't be centered in Silicon Valley. We can already see the funding moving to regions around the country. For instance, I was at a facility up in Detroit that was financed by the state of Michigan, Michigan State University's, the Department of Energy, and the car companies, just as mostly a test and development center for composite materials. So, for instance, if Ford wanted to build a composite roof, it's kind of hard to test it because their manufacturing facilities are busy
manufacturing
cars. Right. So this is sort of a joint facility where they can go in and test things. Mm. And other car companies do it too, as well as companies in other fields. Although that particular center is mainly focused on cars. So that's what I would say. You need to get out and widen and deepen your connections. And that's what's really key.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because I absolutely agree with you. I think it's now's the time. It's not so much about going deep with your skill, but going wide and connecting a lot of different dots. As well as what you said, which I hadn't really thought of it that way, but for launch readers, just to hear about staying relevant is really about getting out there and connecting with the people doing it and learning and leveraging it versus, to your point, just sitting in a conference room coming up with ideas. How do you become more of that connector? Because I think, as you had said in an article I read, that connection drives transformation. So how do we do that on a day-to-day basis?
Connection drives transformation is actually a much bigger topic, right? We know that networks run on density. And that's what creates trends on a sort of superficial level. It's also what moves technologies. I think the key thing is we need to get away from this idea that we can constantly adapt. Mm. You need to prepare rather than adapt. As soon as you start adapting, you're already losing. That's like admitting that you're losing. Obviously, you have to do that sometimes, but that can't be the goal. You have to prepare. If you look at Google, nobody talks about how Google adapts to the search engine, right?
Right.
But when they tried to adapt to other things like social media, they didn't do very well. Mm. When they prepared for things like self-driving cars, they did very well. Same thing with Microsoft in the cloud. They didn't adapt to the cloud. Microsoft is leading in the cloud today because they started building cloud technologies way back in 2000, 2001 when they started their tools and servers division. It wasn't even called cloud computing.
Wait, I want to break it down a second before you go on about adapt, because I think that well, I'm curious from your perspective, what the difference is between, let's take Google as your example. So they really are, they've created the modern search engine from the user perspective, and they continue to edit, right, how they do it or adjust how they do it and their algorithms and what they do based on what's working, what's not working. And I think sometimes that is defined as adaptation inside organizations. But I hear you saying that a little differently. So will you break that down a little bit? Because I don't want the assumption to be that you can't change and evolve as the market changes. But I think what you're saying is a little bit different.
Right. You can change and evolve. You just won't win. You might be able to keep up. And Google's a very, very agile company. But that's not all they do. I mean, one of the most impressive things about Google and Facebook as well, as well as Microsoft and IBM, which is why they're still around, right? I mean, everybody calls IBM a dinosaur, but that's only because 99% of the companies that ever competed with them are long, long gone, right?
Right.
But Facebook and Google are especially impressive because they've learned how to do it so quickly and so young. right? I mean, it's still an open question whether Facebook or Google will be as successful as IBM 50 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, they're still in their teenage years.
Right. But they've made a very, very good start. So one of the most impressive things about Google is how they integrate a bunch of different innovation strategies together. So some of them people have heard of, like their 20% time, their X division, and some other things.
Yeah.
But one, the probably their most important strategy is something that nobody ever talks about. In fact, I don't think I've heard about it anywhere except from people who work within the company. And that is their academic program. And they have several different parts of the program where they engage with academic researchers. But probably the most important part is what that ladders up to, which is their visiting faculty program. And there they invite some of the world's greatest minds to come and work at Google for a year on just sort of a regular salary. It's not particularly expensive. But every single thing that they are working on, whether it's quantum computing, whether it's auction algorithms, whether it's artificial intelligence, they have the world's best minds from universities doing groundbreaking work within Google on those sabbaticals. And they bring it about 50 every year, I believe. So that's really preparing. That's getting in on the ground floor on technologies they feel that are important to them long before a profitable application becomes obvious.
So what do you say then to companies like, oh, I'll just take an example. I don't want to kind of pick on anyone in particular, but let's say you're in the fast food or fast casual market, right? You're a restaurant, you've been around forever, big global brand, let's say, let's give them some longevity. And their marketplace, like what their customers demand from them is starting to drastically change. So is the goal then at that stage to prepare for the real long-term next wave versus respond to today's market needs? How do you, if you're at that point, which I think a lot of organizations are, of like, we've been doing it the way we've always been doing it, and now they're starting to have market share taken away, frankly, where do they go from here?
Well, I'm not an expert on the fast casual business, but let me take a shot, right? So obviously food quality is something that would be important to their customers. And at the top of food quality, you'd have to put food safety. Well, food safety is important to your business. You really need to start thinking about blockchain and how you're going to make that work. And in fact, that's what Walmart is doing. They just announced, actually, I'm talking to Walmart about it this afternoon. They just announced a major initiative where they're shifting their entire supply chain, food supply chain, to blockchain. So that is, I would believe that in the fast casual business, that would be a must have, right? I mean, if you're not seriously working on blockchain, you could have yourself a real problem, right? Especially if you get some sort of salmonella scare, right? And I think every business has things like that. I've even heard back to my point about material science. Now, material science is something that very few people have heard of because very few companies invest in it. It's extremely expensive. So you only really see it in categories that have very, very large addressable markets, things like semiconductors, cars, airplanes. And we recently saw a few years ago, Boeing came out with their 787 Dreamliner, which was pretty much like their 777, except they re-engineered the materials in the plane. So it was 20% lighter and 20% more efficient,
right?
Which is a major selling point.
Huge, yeah.
Especially and when you leverage that across the global market for airplanes, you're talking about a lot of money there. But now that the material science technologies are really taking off, and we'll see, I think, at least a 10x improvement in efficiency over the next 10 years because of things like materials genomes, high throughput computing, machine learning are being applied to this research. You're starting to see cosmetics companies, consumer goods companies starting to take a serious look at material science, and that will open up absolutely new possibilities for product development. So that's another example of where you need to basically have an idea what new technologies can affect your industry, and then start doing the groundwork, going to conferences, engaging with leaders in the area, so that when it hits the point that you can envision a practical application, you are ready to go instead of having your competitor do it and then trying to catch up.
Yeah.
Then trying to figure out, you know, then being 1 or 2 years behind the curve.
Do you think that smaller companies and startups have a greater handle on this, or is that just not even relevant?
I would say in lots of cases they have a worse handle on it, especially that small, medium enterprise. Let's go back to the Google example of their academic program. You know, any company can really do that. I mean, find me a company of any size that isn't located near some university,
within
an hour's drive of some university. Those universities have graduate students, have postdocs. You can engage with those people. You can bring them in for lectures. You can bring them in one day a week. And not just in the hard sciences, but if you look at things like usability, advertising, marketing, you can bring people in like cognitive psychologists and people in other fields to help shift your thinking and help you learn about what your consumers are doing or what's going on in your industry. But you have to get out and engage with them. And I have to tell you, because I speak to these people all the time, they want their work to be useful. And they want to know what's going on in the private sector because that's why they do what they're doing in the first place, to have an impact.
Yeah, right. I bet you if you're a smaller business too, you're thinking, well, they would never come talk to me. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we want the work that we do to have impact
also,
far beyond the four walls.
Most postdocs, they're living on ramen, right? I mean, they're
that's true.
There's some companies that engage with local universities. They give out research awards. You know, you're talking about a couple thousand dollars, which means a hell of a lot to a graduate student.
I mean, that's a lot of ramen right there.
That's a lot of ramen.
I'm going to kind of shift us to another thing I wanted to ask you about. How does the, I'm sure I got it right, the 70-20-10 rule help you innovate?
Well, just to be clear, that is that's not a physical law, right? It's a basic rule of thumb, and it basically says you want to do Google applies this rule, so let's look at Google. So Google tries to spend about 70% of its resources on things that you talked about, tweaking their search algorithm, tweaking their auction algorithms, everything that applies to their current technologies and current customers. 20% goes to adjacent markets and adjacent technologies, and 10% goes to exploration. I would say that as a rule of thumb, most companies are pretty good at the 70 and 20, but completely neglect the 10. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to ask yourself, what are you doing to explore? Because one of the things I found in my research for the book was that what made the best innovators different, the one attribute they all had in common, besides collaboration, was that they had a systematic and disciplined process for identifying new problems to solve. Mm.
And so can you give us a hint of what those systems or processes are, or even a story behind one?
So Experian, they have something called Data Labs, which the only job, it doesn't have any P&L, any revenue targets. Their only job is to go to customers and ask what problems they're having. Mm-hmm. Whereas Eric Haller, who runs the Data Lab, says, what's giving their customers agita? Mm-hmm. And when they find a good one, a problem they see has some potential, they bring it back to Data Labs, which is stock full of world-class data scientists, and usually can come back with a prototype within 90 days. And eventually it goes back to one of the operating divisions to scale up into a real business. IBM has a very similar type of idea called Grand Challenges. You probably know one of the most recent ones, which was the Jeopardy Grand Challenge, yeah, which led to their Watson business. It's not the most recent. The most recent is something called Debater, which is machines debating humans. Mm-hmm. The two earlier ones were Blue Gene and Deep Blue, which beat Kasparov in chess. They didn't have any idea how they were going to make money out of any of that stuff, but all of them turned into multi-billion dollar businesses. So they're not looking for problems that will take them 90 days to solve. They're looking for problems that will take them years or even decades to solve. One final example is Google's 20% time acts as kind of like a human powered search engine for problems, because they know if somebody's 20% time project starts attracting a lot of people to work on it, it's probably a pretty good and interesting problem.
So who is responsible for that innovation? Are you in the club of like everybody in some way innovates in their job, like whether you're part of the 70, right, and your job is to tweak the algorithm, or if you're part of the 10%. And granted, one of them is focused on the ship that's already moving, and one of them is focused on total blue and kind of what's new. But who ultimately, how does innovation become responsible across that 70-20-10?
That's really the leader's job. I mean, the leader needs to make room for that 10%. And that's where most companies fall down, because business leaders aren't trained to innovate. Business leaders are trained to execute. They're trained to run an operation. They're not trained to explore. Shareholders don't reward exploration until, you know, you find something big or something really bad happens, like at GE. I mean, if you want to look at the root of what GE's problems are now, they did plenty of 70 and 20, but they haven't invented anything. They haven't invented a new category since, I think, 1975 or 6 when they came out with CT scanners. And you can't, no matter how smart you are, you can't predict every turn in the market. You can't predict every market development, every economic trend. Eventually, you're going to get disrupted. This whole idea that only stupid, silly people get disrupted is how you get into trouble. You have to assume you're going to get disrupted. And if once you assume that you're disruptive, you're going to be disrupted, the answer, the way forward is obvious. We got to find something else to do before that happens.
Right.
And that's what you can see Facebook and Google doing, even at their young age.
So what do you do as a leader then if you recognize kind of, you know, Greg, what you're saying is true, but you're in a system that, to your point, maybe it rewards outcomes and there are consequences for failures, right? Where that's all you get. So that exploration time is usually minimized or shoved off the table because you got to hit your numbers and deal with your stuff today. And there's always a fire. So how do you shift that if you're in that role?
Well, I think we're talking about two different types of leaders. Senior leaders absolutely have to make it a priority, and you'll have to start early, because when you talk about things like grand challenges, you are not talking about a lot of money. Watson did not cost a lot of money. But you need that sort of low-level, sustained effort. So that's the first thing. You need to figure out how you can make that feasible, how you can do it at a low enough level that you can sustain over time, because that's what creates the big thing at the end. At the more mid-level leaders, and I would say more generally, because I hear this all the time, wherever I go around the world, people say, nobody will listen to my ideas.
Yeah.
And my answer is always the same. Right. nobody's going to listen to your ideas. They have their own ideas. Innovation isn't about ideas. It's about solving problems. So you need, instead of trying to come up with some great fantastical idea, you need to go and look for a good, meaningful problem to solve. Mm. And people will listen to problems.
That's interesting. And I'm just taking a note as you say that. That's interesting. I was just talking to a potential client the other day who's a global company, and I was saying they were talking about getting buy-in for something they want to do. And I said, you know, people need to feel the pain before they see the possibilities.
Absolutely.
It's right. Kind of what you're saying too, which is focus on the problem that you have identified and are going to solve. And then if you get buy-in on the problem, you'll ultimately get buy-in on the idea. And I would add to that, and I think you were saying it earlier with some of your conversation about collaboration, is that that idea is never really fully formed from one person, whatever that solution is. It really should be a collaborative approach because everybody has different pieces of the puzzle. So, you know, that kind of myth of I go off and innovate and come back is also part of the problem.
Right. That's the myth of the lone genius,
yes.
I call it.
Yes.
Which never happens. No. One of the things, the most interesting thing I think I learned from my book is that when I talk to a lot of these people, and one of the most interesting people I talked to, by the way, was Jim Allison, and he personifies this concept. Jim Allison, by the way, on Monday won the Nobel Prize,
yes,
for medicine. One of the world's nicest people. But when you talk to somebody like Jim Allison, you know, you're a little bit intimidated.
Yeah.
Actually, a lot intimidated. I mean, here's this towering figure. Nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And the same thing with Charlie Bennett, who came up with the concepts that led to quantum computing, and so many others. And I started thinking, you know, these guys are all so nice. It can't be an accident. And what I found was, I did some more research, and what I found was, is that generosity can actually be a competitive advantage. Mm. And that's really the type of people you want to look for, because great innovators, they're not knowledge holders. They're not necessarily more talented or smarter or more ambitious than anybody else, but they have better networks.
Yeah.
And that, because they're kind and sharing and generous, they have a much larger network of people who want to share information and insights with them. And that makes them much more likely to come across that random piece of insight that could leads to cracking a really, really tough problem.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I was just having this conversation with someone the other day about Malcolm Gladwell and his emails that he puts out, which are great and full of insight. And they said to me, how does he do it? Does he just read a ton? And my response was, and I don't know Malcolm Gladwell personally, but my response was, I bet you he has teams of people that he taps into every day. Like, you cannot sit at your desk and come up with all that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. He does. And one of the things that amazes me about Malcolm Gladwell is how he is able to spot an emerging science years before almost anybody else knows that it exists. What I don't like about Malcolm Gladwell is he doesn't follow up very well, because pretty much all of his books, the top leaders in the field, including people that he covered, you know, basically say he got it way, way wrong, starting with Tipping Point and network science.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's really good at is taking really seemingly large and complex topics and making them very digestible for the everyday person. And I think he's brilliant at that. And I don't disagree with what you're saying about, like, he's not following up. So, of course, he got it wrong because he didn't see it through. But
well, in a lot of cases, like, for instance, I have two chapters on network science in my next book called Cascades. I had, you know, people like Duncan Watts and Steve Strogatz, some of the same people that he covered in Tipping Point. I had them look through my chapters to make sure that I got it right. He could have done that. I know both of them. They're very open to communicating, and most of the top people are. Which is how they got to where they were.
Yeah, of course. Well, that goes to your point about connections and networks. And I mean, I couldn't agree more. I don't think I could do what I do alone in my garage, according to the myth. It just doesn't work that way. Before I get into the last question, just before we run out of time, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
both of my websites, gregsattell.com is the best place to reach me if you would like to engage with me on speaking engagement or consulting or something like that. And digitaltonto.com is where all of my articles go eventually, whether they're they first are published on Inc. or Harvard Business Review or somewhere else.
Got it. So there's actually two things I want to close with. One is a piece of advice, which I'll get to. But the other one was, I was hoping, I think it's the first chapter of your book, you share a story, which is really the chronological history of how we got to iPhones in a lot of ways, kind of to the Apple, right? Will you go through that with us? Because I think that I love the story, and I'm mostly knew it going into reading it. But as I was reading, I thought to myself, this is such a great reminder of how new innovations, new technologies, whatever it is, really come to be. That it isn't just this overnight one person thing, like with Steve Jobs that we all think. It really is this kind of cascading effect of events and people and circumstances. So okay. Would you just share it?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the Douglas Engelbart story.
Yeah, when you're talking, like it starts with – anyway, I'll let you
– I would like to tell a different story that makes the same point a little bit faster.
Sure.
About the 30 years rule.
Yeah.
And this is one – you know, there's certain stories you hear at innovation conferences over and over and over again. The Blockbuster story, the Kodak story, the Xerox story, almost none of which are true. By the way, but that's for another podcast.
Right.
But one of the stories you do hear, not quite so frequent as them, but also quite frequently, is the Alexander Fleming story. Do you know this one?
I have heard of it, but I don't know that all our launch shooters have. So do it.
He goes into his lab in 1928 and realizes that a mysterious mold has infected his petri dishes, and was eradicating the bacteria colonies he was trying to grow. And instead of throwing it out, he decided to study the mold, and that's how he invented penicillin. And that's all true, but it leaves out some important points. First of all, penicillin didn't become commercially available till almost 20 years later. Hmm. Second of all, the reason why it took so long is when he published his findings, nobody really paid them any attention. Third of all, nobody paid any attention because what Alexander Fleming had discovered was completely useless. You couldn't store it. You couldn't inject it. You certainly wouldn't want to ingest it. You couldn't make it nearly enough quantities to be therapeutically effective. And it wasn't until 10 years later, another group, which was made up of a much more diverse set of talents, Fleming largely worked alone, that eventually made it, figured out how to make penicillin, how to ferment it, how to transform it into a storable powder, made it into something that could cure mice. Still couldn't cure humans. Actually, the first time they tried, the patient died because they ran out of penicillin. They couldn't make it fast enough.
Right.
So then they went to America. They started working with a number of other labs. They identified a much more potent strain of penicillin, which is in fact the penicillin we know today, not Fleming's version, a new fermentation medium called corn steep liquor, which was very, very common in the American Midwest, but almost unheard of back in England where their lab was. And then the U.S. government basically ordered, because this is World War II by this point, two dozen manufacturing pharmaceutical manufacturers to start working out all the problems with logistics and production, everything else you need to go from milliliters in the lab to metric tons in the real world. So what you hear about was one guy, one epiphany, one, you know, chance happening, actually turns out to have taken nearly 20 years. It encompassed the work of a number of different labs and hundreds, if not thousands of people, once you take into account every, you know, all the things that go into manufacturing and logistics and everything else. And every technology has a story just like that. It doesn't just happen.
I love that story, and I've heard part of it, but not the full thing. But I Launch Readers, what I want you to hear from that story is exactly what he said at the end, which is it doesn't just happen. There are innovation, so many things.
Innovation is never a single event.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I loved about that story, as well as the Steve Jobs story you shared and kind of everything leading up to that, because I do think we have this myth that, you know, it's like this aha moment that turns into transformative innovation within a minute. And it doesn't.
I would like to make one more point, if I could.
Sure.
About and I remember this specifically in speaking to Jim Allison, but generally when I talk to people who make these big breakthroughs, at their breakthrough moment, generally they're not shouting Eureka.
Right.
What they are, they're much more worried about, did I get it right? How can I verify these findings? How can I double check my work? Is it real? So when you feel yourself shouting Eureka, make sure you go back and check that you got it right.
Love it. What's one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there looking to innovate in this disruptive age?
I think that's a pretty good one. Other than that, I would say, again, don't go looking for some great fantastical idea. Go looking for a good, meaningful problem you can solve and then get to work on solving.
Yeah, I think that is incredible advice. And launch readers out there, I hope you're really paying attention. And I also think it forces us to sit in the problem a little bit longer. We tend to try to jump to solution. And I find that when we do that, we don't always get the problem right because we haven't thought about it actually long enough or done our due diligence. So we're actually sometimes solving the wrong problem because we're jumping to solution mode so fast.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. We are of like minds.
Well, there you go. Well, that's why this was so fun. Well, Greg, thank you so much. It was fantastic to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
What did you think? Was I right or what about Greg's interview, about this whole shift in the era that we're in and what it means to us? And I loved his whole thing around, you know, innovators are connectors. They're people out there gathering these experiences, which, by the way, on the IQE, your innovator archetype, on the assessment I was talking about in the intro, if you're a collaborative, this is totally you naturally. This is how you're going to win in today's era. And for the rest of us, how we innovate is going to connect to that. And we really need to think about, how do we connect more of those people? How do we continue to be connectors in our world? All right. There's so much in this interview. It's hard for me to stick on one thing. So my action for you is what I said in the beginning. Go get your innovator archetype. Understand how you can innovate and adapt, because that's what you're going to need as we make this shift. If you've already taken the promo level, the free level, and you just have one piece of the puzzle, go back in and get your full report. I promise you it's worth your while to understand this about you. And if you have that full report, open it back up. Take a look at it. Let it sink in. Make sure that you're actually using it. I mean, there's this whole knowing and doing gap I'm sure you've all heard of. It's one thing to know that stuff about you. It's another thing to do it. That's why there's actual kind of things that you can do in the report. Plus, we have all these on-demand online resources too that I'll talk about another time. But for now, step one, go online, get your innovator archetype, innovate and adapt. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.